So, step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We're going to start on page 5 in the big book, in Bill's story. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did.
Hey everybody, my name's Mike, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Mike.
I have a sponsor, he's really close to me right now. I have a home group meeting, it's 49th Street Living Sober. We meet Thursdays at 5:30 on the campus of ODU. And my sobriety date is January 7th, 2008. And if you're new, I want you to hear that. I'm one of those New Year's sober babies who couldn't get through the holidays. So if you're feeling it right now, I've been there. I know what it's like to, and we're going to talk about this, no humility and cocksuredness. I knew I could get through one more holiday. And I got through it, but I sure didn't get through it sober. So that's my sobriety date. I'm going to read you some things that we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about desperate desire, suffering and humiliation, bodily and mentally different, delusional, smashed, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, progressive illness, and death. Doesn't that sound exciting? That's what we're going to talk about. And the reason I bring that up is 2 years ago, as I was doing this exact same step with the exact same person sitting right here, and he stopped both of us who was up here with me, and he was like, we are talking about getting better and things are going to get good. And but these are the words that the man wrote in the book, and I just wanted them to get out of the way first, because I've been through these steps a few times. I've been sober a while, and every time I do, I get something different. And at first, when I did step one for the first time and the second time and the third time, whatever, I thought, man, it's not that big a deal. It's easy. Quit drinking, get your life together, and get on and get going. But then I read those words and I'm like, wow, this is some serious stuff. It's real. It's very serious. It's the groundwork for everything else that's going to come later. So I'm not going to read those words anymore. But it's tough. So we're going to get to the good parts too. The reason I love Simple Actions is because Amy asked me to do this probably 3 or 4 months ago. So I get to show my true alcoholism. I get to print out all the readings and write on them and highlight them and get myself together. So if it doesn't look like this is coming straight from my heart, it is. Even though I do have cheat notes, you know, because I get scared. I'm nervous about this. First two paragraphs, this is how much time I had on my hands. I circled all the times that he said the word I. It's 12 times, you know, so that's us. In the beginning, he's telling you he's just like me, or I'm just like him. I. I came home drunk. I wrote letters. I told my wife I was going to be better. I woke up. I was crazy. He's not saying a thing about anybody else yet, because he's a really good drunk, and he's letting you know that it's all about him right now. You know, he cannot stop. He doesn't know why yet. We're not there yet. We're not even close. And he's just laying the groundwork to say, hey, however you feel, you know, when you wake up in the morning and you know it has to stop and you know it's crazy. 80 years ago, the same guy felt the same, this guy felt the same way, but it's still I. And then it gets down to this, the paragraph about laughing at the gin mills and, you know, I'm going to get good and drunk. He's telling you, man, the way our character defects, big ego, no humility, nothing's going to stop us. We got this. And that's how I drank. Sounds like that's how he drank. You know, I'll have a good night out. I'll have a bad night out. Doesn't matter. I'm just going to have another night out. Doesn't matter to me. And it doesn't. And it doesn't matter who I run over, who I step on. I've got it. It's all Mike. Thanks.
Good evening, everyone. My name is James, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, James.
Yeah, so with the notes and everything, I went on YouTube and did step one this morning just to see what all was out there, and hit up a little Chris Raymer and Father Martin, and there's a lot of really good stuff. But before I get kind of really going with this, a couple of things I want to make sure I don't forget to say is I want to thank Simple Actions, David, and everybody for giving me this opportunity to work on my sobriety. Thank you all for coming out this evening, because it's together that we stay sober, and I can't do it without you, so I appreciate you being here. Thank you. And then the other thing that I want to make sure that we say, Mike touched on a little bit, but before we get out of here, one thing I want to make sure is real crystal clear is that there is hope, regardless of this thing with the powerlessness and the obsession. And I have a phenomenon of craving, and I'm an alcoholic. But if we run out of time, or if I flat out forget, then I want to make sure that I make it very clear that there is absolutely hope. And I'm in a position today where I don't have to drink. And if I keep doing what I've been doing, I won't have to drink. And that's just the God's truth. So everything else kind of is what it is. But when I stay square in the middle of this deal with the service, recovery, unity, and when I'm working these steps, then that's also the plain truth. Yes, I have a sponsor. My sponsor also has a sponsor. My home group is Joys of Recovery. We are a big book study. We meet Thursday nights. You're welcome to come on out and join us. We're at Grace Lutheran on Providence Road in Chesapeake. And we go through the entire book, the recovery portion, as well as the stories in the back, talking about identification in the opening. And identification is a precursor to all of it. Because if I didn't identify, it wouldn't matter really pretty much anything else you said. You know, if I didn't identify with you, if I didn't identify as an alcoholic. So we go through the whole book. My sobriety date is April the 15th, 2014. And I am really glad to be here this evening. So in taking a look at this part that was read first, and I guess we're going to read a little bit, and then we'll share, and then we'll read a little more, keep it going through that way. But I guess kind of what jumps out to mind at first for me is with Bill's story. One of the first things that my sponsor had me to do, going back to that identification piece, was to read Bill's story and to underline or circle, what have you, how I thought, how I felt, and how I drank, like Bill, similar to the way he did, to kind of stay away from or stay off of the fact that this was 1939, and right now it's 2014 when I was getting sober, 2015, so this is 80 years ago. You know, I'm an educator, I'm not a stockbroker. I'm this, I'm not that. There's real easy for me to compare myself out. I never lost my, I didn't lose my house, I didn't lose my wife, both of my cars were in the garage, and my children were at home. I hadn't been arrested since college. I mean, there's all kinds of ways I can try to convince myself and you I'm not an alcoholic. But going through the story and looking at how I thought, felt, and drank like Bill helped me to identify and recognize some of these things in myself that are also shared here. So in the part that we read tonight, one of the things that I have underlined and highlighted here is this: I woke up and this had to be stopped. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. And that strange mental blank spot is talked about in some of the readings we'll read tonight. But I'm real familiar with that weird mental blank spot where it's like, just don't think, just drink. If you think about it, you're going to remember how awful it is. If you think about it, you're going to remember how you're not supposed to be doing it. So as I'm on my way to the ABC store, as I'm on my way to 7-Eleven, I'm real careful to clamp that down and not think I can do it deliberately. And it can also sneak up on me without any warning and without any thought at all. All of a sudden, I look down and the Southern Comfort is back in my hand and I'm drinking. And then the physical part kicks in, my craving kicks in, and I start to feel a little bit of the ease and comfort, and I'm off to the races again. So that powerlessness for me has been out of the blue with no intent, and it's also been kind of completely intentional too, where I've like done it on purpose to make sure that I'm not resisting anything that's in between me and that ease and comfort that can come from alcohol. So some of this was like crazy. I mean, you know, with the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I'd manage better next time. I may as well get good and drunk. You know, I can really relate to all of that. So I guess that's it for this one. Thanks.
All right, we're going to continue on page 7. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. Mike?
Yeah, when I first got here, I did not want to. I was cornered, like a lot of us get. I was cornered. This was a place that, you know, my wife and my mom and dad and people I knew thought, oh, maybe that'll help him. Maybe he'll get it straight. But I came in here like a lot of people do, looking for a way out, just looking for some clearance, just some breathing room. And when I read the big book, I was looking for breathing room, and he gave it to me. You know, he said right here, my will's a little shaky when it comes to liquor, but when everything else remains strong, that's cool. You know, I'm good at baseball. I like that. I'm good. See, the man said I'm good. You know, I like to read and I can write and I go to work. I'm good. There's nothing. This alcohol is not whipping me. It's not, because I'm still saying me. You know, I got this. There's nothing. Yeah, I have some hangovers. Yeah, like James, I got arrested twice, but that was when I was young. You know, I've been married twice, but that's when I was young. You know, I've been bankrupt twice, and that's when I was young. You know, it all sounds good now, and it didn't get crazy till later. So, you know, self-knowledge, I had it every single day. I mean, with those people, you know, my mom and dad, you need to back off a little bit. No, I'm not drinking that much. I mean, I would tell them, no, I'm not. But then I would never talk to them after noon, because my mom called me on it. Just why? I only took her once. Are you been drinking? You're slurring. That's it. I'm not talking to you unless it's in the morning, because I don't want to hear it, you know. My wife, you know, you need to cut back. We told this story to my 16-year-old son. This is how crazy alcoholism affects a family and us and all this. You know, he's 16, so now he's, before he'd ask questions about alcoholism and drinking because he just, you know, was worried about me. Now I think he's setting the base for his own little actions to see what's going to happen to him, right? You know, he's laying the groundwork to see what could happen to him. And we tell him, you know, things that we did, as if the craziness in our house. The biggest fights in our house were not beer cans and bottles everywhere. That was regular day. If my wife found a wet washcloth jammed in the sofa or somewhere around the house, she would get nuts because she knew I had a bad night and I had lied about how much I drank. One little stupid wet washcloth that I put on my head to sleep would start World War III. And that's the insanity of this disease. That's not, like I said, not the bottles, not the cans. I would tell her that I was okay and she'd find that wet washcloth. And that was it. Oh, here we go. So, you know, self-knowledge. Alcohol was good to me. How dare you tell me I need to cut back? We're good. I'll cut back when I need to cut back. I had no idea that why I drank so much. You know, why didn't I drink 100 of those? I can drink a bottle of that water and stop, but for some reason, and I will say this also, a lot of times when you're new, when I was new, I was scared to death at everything people said who'd been here a while, because I thought I missed going to health class in PE, I mean in 12th grade, because you all knew about it. I knew nothing about an allergic reaction or a mental obsession, and if you're new, we're going to get there. You know, if you drink like I did, once you picked up, you couldn't stop. The end. That's it. All amounts of self-knowledge. You know, I was just like, I was a big drinker. That was my self-knowledge. Mike drinks a lot. Let's keep going. But we're going to get to in a little bit, because that's going to change in a little bit. So, thanks.
Yeah, so I drank for 29 years. I started when I was 17. I was halfway through my junior year of high school. And what got me started was one big pissed off resentment. I had, through middle and high school, I had hung around with a lot of the stoners and burnouts, but I didn't party. I didn't drink, didn't get high, didn't do anything. I was the designated driver for all of my friends. And then one day my dad came home and said, we're moving to Chicago. And I didn't want to leave all my friends in Houston. And I was pissed. When I got to Chicago, I was like, screw you, watch this. I've been good, I've maintained my grades, I don't drink, I don't get high, but you're gonna do this to me anyway, screw you, watch. And I proceeded to get drunk and high and party for all through, you know, like I say, 29 years. I had years where I drank for fun, tried to get as drunk as possible. I had years that just, I call them my maintenance years. I mean, I just drank just to be even. It really wasn't a problem, but it wasn't a good thing, wasn't a bad thing. It just was there. And then the last 10 years, I tried to stop and I just couldn't. And I share all that to say, you know, to highlight that same point, like I did not know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know what a mental obsession was. I didn't know what a physical craving was. I just tried to stop. And, you know, the big book shares a lot about different ways we try to stop by trying, you know, different kinds of alcohol, making these little deals and promises, et cetera. Me personally, I didn't go through any of that. I just tried to stop. I just said, I wasn't drinking. I'm not going to drink. And then I did anyway. And that just kept going forever, it seemed, until one day it just got bad enough. And in order to keep my wife from being pissed, I called the AA hotline. And then, you know, went to a meeting, and that was when, you know, I started this journey and started learning all these things. And so, like in the part we read, one thing I have highlighted is my incredible behavior in the face of this desperate desire to stop was explained. And that hit me really hard because I had a desperate desire to stop. I was trying with every ounce of my being to stop, and I just wasn't. And I honestly didn't get it. I thought I was a loser. I thought I was weak. I thought there was something like really fundamentally broken in me. And while I might accept that that's actually true, that wasn't what I meant at the time. I thought I had a judgment on it. I had like a value on it. I had like a loserness on it that today I recognize was just my own insanity. Now it's just, I mean, that's what it is, what it is. I mean, it's just a part of me. So, you know, I've come to accept that. But the part in the doctor's opinion that goes along with this that really helped me a lot as well is on page Roman numeral 29, I guess. I don't know, hard to read those real fast, but it says, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. And it talks about how there's a physical aspect, but it also talks about how the willpower, it just doesn't apply here. It's like not relevant. So it's not the fact that I'm powerless over it. Yeah, sure, but my willpower, it just doesn't come into play. It's like having no traction in the ice. You can spin all you want to. The tire is moving really fast. You're not going to go anywhere because there's no friction. And that, when it comes to the powerlessness with alcoholism, that's what it's like for me. It's just, I can spin that wheel. I can try not to drink. It just doesn't enter this equation. I'm going to, you know, without these steps, I'm going to. Thanks. Nice.
We're going to continue on page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
Mike? Yeah, this is in the first part when it says when we can't even force the memory of the suffering and humiliation a week or a month, last 5 or 6 years of my drinking, I couldn't even get those memories back daily. Drank every day. If I had known what AA was and what white chips were, I'd have a box, because I quit every day. Every single day for 5 or 6 years, I quit. Mike quit. I got up. I've told this, some of you have heard this, but I'd get ready to go to school about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, take a shower so I could feel better, get something in my stomach, go greet 25-year-olds who think I'm the king of everything. And if you can imagine having a hangover with 25-year-olds ready to go every single day and your eyes are just ready to bleed, that was my day, every day. And I'm never going to drink again. And then at noon, man, I'd get one of them good school rolls in my belly and soak it up a little bit more. 3 o'clock, I'm like, it's a good idea to just stop at 7-Eleven on the way to get my baby, to get my son, get a couple beers in me before I get to the babysitter, get home. I had two high school girls at the time. My girls are now adults. But I would get home and I would say, look, Dad's had a rough day. They're doing their honors homework. They're working. But man, I had a rough day. So I'm going to go. I was really good drunk. I would take 6 beers in the garage and ride the exercise bike, because I'm a healthy drunk. And I didn't need a clock, because I knew 6 beers was an hour. And I'd ride the bike, and when I finished the last beer, that was an hour. And so then, now it's 4:30-ish. So it's afternoon, and I'd go in the house, and my buzz is going, and I'd tell the girls, oh man, you know, I'm gonna watch TV a little bit. Can you watch your brother some more? And then, you know, my wife's an administrator in the school system. She's a bigwig. And I mean that very lovingly. I wish I had said it like that. But all of a sudden, I'd start calling her. Where are you? She's making the dough. Like, I'm that guy. I'm like, I'm the teacher, and that's fine. But she makes the big money, right? But I'm that guy who's calling and saying, you need to get home and feed these kids. You need to get home and watch your baby. I've watched him. I haven't watched nothing. You know, the girls are watching him. They're changing his diaper. They're taking care of him. And that went on for really 5 or 6 years daily. And I've said this also before. We had to leave it to Beaver family meeting at the end of my drinking, where we all sat down, every one of us. And I said, if you guys are good with me being here every day and getting drunk, then I'll be here. And if you're not, I didn't really honestly think if you're not. And they said, we're not. And I'm like, what? Wait a minute. There wasn't really a choice there. I was kind of telling you again. I'm telling you. And they said, leave. And I had to go. And that was it for a while. And then there's this part. So that's the part where he's introducing, you know, like James read in the doctor's opinion, that's the part about the allergies there. Now he's that's pretty much it. I can't summon that memory. I can't. I don't know why. I know it's going to be bad. I do. I know it's going to be terrible. But I can't remember how bad, and most of, to me, was pretty good. So I'm gonna start drinking again, and I can't stop once I start. I just can't. And then it gets to this thing with the stove. You know, putting your hand on a hot stove. The second part of step one, you know, our lives have become unmanageable. When I first read that, and I'm sure a lot of you did, I read the jaywalking thing. I'm like, what a bunch of stupid people. Why are you going to run in front of a car over and over? That makes no sense. You're going to put your hand on a hot stove once, right? Why would you keep putting your hand? That doesn't make, who's going to read that and get anything out of that? That's just like picking up a drink to us. Every single time I did it, I might as well have just put my hand on that hot stove, because that's what was going to happen. I was not going to stop. Something bad didn't always happen. But the odds were sure way on that favor that something bad would, you know, and something bad doesn't have to be you wreck a car. You know, something bad could be you lie every single day of your life to the people you love the most. You know, you look them right in the face. I'm not doing it. I didn't do it. I didn't go in your purse, whatever. You know when I did. Every single day. It doesn't have to be this blown up thing. It's, you know, I was so proud of myself when I first came in here, and I was like, I didn't steal anything from anybody. You can steal love. You can steal trust. You can break people's hearts like that. And that's what we do. We get to, it's weird. My wife and I still have these discussions. The people that are closest are the ones we rack up the most because they trust us the most. It's easy. And I'm not saying that proudly, but it's easy. It's easy to twist them up. And we're an alcoholic house that is still together. I have a wife and three kids, and the girls are adults, and they still come over. Sometimes we're crazy, and we always will be. And I brought that crazy on everybody, and I live with it, and that's what it is. But I still have to go back to step one a lot because our lives are manageable and they're unmanageable. And I have to remember when that is. And I also have to remember that I presented all that unmanageability to them. They didn't come with that. Daddy brought that to them, you know. So that's just part of how we do things. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. So towards the towards the end of my drinking, right before coming in to AA and working a program, my wife and I didn't really talk about my drinking too much. It was like the elephant in the room. We just ignored it the way that's our main coping mechanism. If you ignore something long enough, it will eventually go away. It's just the price you might have to pay to get to that point can sometimes be pretty high. But she said to me, so basically I spend a lot of time being very angry at you. And so when we talk about, you know, stealing other things besides money, you know, that's very, very true. You know, the part that we read just now, this little section that was selected from the book, the first piece is in italics. And in the big book, when something's in italics, it's really, really important. And just before what we read tonight, like I said, my sponsor had me go through this section and underline the things about how I thought, felt, and drank like Bill. And one of the parts that I have kind of emphasized heavily in my book is the sentence right before all that. It says, this tragic situation, the part about losing control in drinking and not having a choice and forfeiting that choice if we ever had it in the first place. But it says, this tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. And I think that's the case with myself as well, because like I said, I spent a lot of years drinking and it was fun. And it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't a problem for me. It might have been a problem for other people, but it wasn't a problem for me. And I had occasion to go back and visit two of my college roommates shortly after I'd gotten sober, almost sober a couple months, 5-6 months, whatever. And, you know, they had asked me, it's like, well, you're sober now, you want us to, you know, not bring any alcohol, or we can leave it, you know, whatever. And I was like, no, you know, knock yourselves out. I'm the one getting sober, you know, you do you. And so we were sitting out on a porch one evening at this on this beach house as part of the vacation, and I'd asked my one college roommate, I'm like, why are you not an alcoholic? Like, I was there. I saw how much you drank. Like, we were together at the same parties. Like, I don't understand why I have this problem and you don't. And what she said to me was, no, I didn't. I didn't drink like you. Like, I had a red Solo cup, sure. I paid the $2 at the kegger, sure. But I didn't fill it up every chance I got. You know, I might have drank two beers. And then my other, you know, there were like three of us that we pretty much ran together through high school and college. And my other buddy was like, well, don't you remember I would always tell you I don't want to lose control? And I was like, yeah, I remember you saying that, but I thought that was because you wanted to like talk to girls and get numbers and like, you know, be out in the town and try to meet somebody. And he's like, yeah. And I didn't want to lose control. And so, you know, it occurred to me that even then, back when I didn't have a problem with it, and in situations where I thought we were all getting hammered, and, you know, plenty of times we all did get hammered, But it's still that matter of perception was at play, where I was out drinking everybody and didn't even realize it at the time, in an environment where everybody was abusing alcohol. And I heard another friend share just the other day, the same thing happened to him. He went back to his family's hunting trip. They go hunting every year, and he was nervous about going. He'd only been sober about 18, 24 months-ish now. He didn't go last year because he was afraid. He didn't want to drink. He wanted to stay sober, so he didn't go. He went this year. He looked around, and he shared with us, holy cow, ain't nobody drinking. It was just me the whole time. And so I'm looking at this, the tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. It arrived for me long before I suspected it. You know, my rule ever since the beginning was, if I can't keep going, then just don't even start. That I knew better than to, if there was some weird circumstance that was going to happen and I could see it coming and I was going to get cut off, like there was physically, literally no more alcohol, then it's better to just not even start. I'll just wait. I'll be good. Because starting and then stopping, that's torture. That's awful. I can do it, and I have done it, and it's hell. And I can use that to convince myself I'm not an alcoholic. Because it says the phenomenon of craving kick in. You don't have a choice. Well, guess what? I can drink two beers and I can stop. I can probably even do it twice in a row. But the misery that comes from that is disproportionate to me sitting here telling you I can do it. And then the third time, or the fourth time, or the inevitable time, it will be get drunk and stay that way. So, you know, the defense against that first drink for me is only there when I'm working the program, and it took the program to teach me that that was even a thing in the first place. Thanks.
Thank you. We're going to continue on page 30. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. Mike?
Yeah, this is where I think he's telling us it's time to face some hard facts right now. You know, like I said before, I thought step one was a checkbox, easy one. One's always the easiest one, right? When you're going down a list, this is going to be the easiest one. And the first thing he says in this paragraph is, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. That is one of the least fun things I ever had to do. You know, and I can giggle now, but who wants to do that? You know, who wants to be that bum under the bridge? But you're not. Who wants to be that guy drinking out of the brown paper bag? But sometimes you're not. You know, you're the kindergarten teacher. You know, you're the doctor. You're the whatever you are. I just go with my story. I'm this kindergarten teacher. That's what I did. That was my job. And I'm a drunk. Doesn't get any harsher than that. And I had to admit that before anything, any of this would work, any of it. And it didn't work because I didn't want to. But when I did, it started to. Then it says, we learned we fully had to concede our innermost selves we were alcoholics. That's the first step in recovery. Damn, step one's not easy. You know, you really have to break yourself down to bare facts of what I am, what I did, what I want to do. Drinking was easy. I could have went back to that and you know, they would have been easy. This is not easy. I'm not going to lie to you. At first I thought, you know, like I said, step one would be easy. I've been through it a few times. It's not easy. And then it says, we alcoholics are men and women who've lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. We get worse, never better. Pretty plain and simple, really, you know. Die an alcoholic death, live a spiritual life, and I still love the alcoholic pause. Maybe. I'd give one more shot. You know, how worse is worse, you know? You know, never better, but maybe it can get good, you know? And that's the fight that inside, I will say, the most eloquent way I've ever heard this said is, there was a friend of mine in here who passed away, and his dad was an alcoholic also, and at his funeral he mentioned alcoholism. He said he would be remiss if he didn't. And he said it's like there was inside of his own head, he was inside of a cage, beating his face on that cage, screaming, pulling his hair out, all of it, and the cage isn't locked. You just got to walk out. And that's what we got to do. We just got to face some very, very, very hard facts about ourselves. It's not easy. It's not. I don't want to be an alcoholic. That wasn't, you know, I don't think my mom, and I'm the oldest of four boys, I don't think they did the Lion King thing and raised me up and said, oh, look, our first alcoholic, we're good. And, you know, and went from there. I don't think it worked like that. I don't think they were really proud. But it is what it is, and we've gotten there, but that takes time too, and I'm not going to sugarcoat that. We're there as a family, but it takes time. So what I'm saying, honestly, is if you're new in that part, you really have to, it says, smash, delusion. Those are some harsh sounding words, but it's true. You've got to get down to bare nothing. Am I ready? Am I ready to give this every single thing I've got? To be sober. And if you are, man, magic happens. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, like Mike has said, the last sentence is, over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. And what I've been told is that's whether we're drinking or not. It keeps getting worse, never better. The progressiveness of our illness, the depth and the intensity of the disease, it keeps on going, whether we're drinking or not. And if I pick up again, I'll be right where I would have been had I been drinking the whole time in short order. Another thing my sponsor had me do when it comes to this part in chapter 3 and more about alcoholism was, I had to circle everywhere it said control, and I had to define some key words. One of those words was obsession. And, you know, I'm an English major. I've got four college degrees for what they're worth. That and the steps of AA will keep me sober. But in looking it up and thinking about what obsession means, it's an idea that outweighs all others. And it persistently and disturbingly persistent and disturbing preoccupation with an idea. So that's when that idea crowds out all the others. And the only idea that I have is an obsession that I can either drink, or I'm going to drink, or when am I going to drink, and how am I going to drink. And I needed to really understand what obsession was. And delusion is the same thing. It's the persistence of a lie to the point that I believe it to be true. That's what a delusion is. It's a lie that I tell myself over and over again, no matter how many times it takes, no matter how long it takes, if I'm deluded, I believe it, even though it's a lie. And so when we have to smash a delusion, that means I've got to let go of what I believe to be true. And, you know, like's been shared, it's not always easy. Fortunately for us, we have a way to do that. That's what the steps do. That's like their whole point, is to help smash that delusion, to help relieve that obsession, so that that idea is no longer the only thing that's crowding our mind, and we no longer have to believe that lie anymore. So those are some really key parts with this. One of the things that I kind of went back and forth with whether to share tonight or not, and I think that I would like to. I mentioned that my home group goes for the whole stories, and we read all of them, and we read the whole book cover to cover. But one of the really persistent parts that came in for me when I first got sober was this concept of control, and this concept of smashing this delusion, and the concept of enjoying the drinking. And on page 334 in the fourth edition, there's a story in there. It's called Crossing the River of Denial. It's very instrumental in my sobriety. Like I said, when I was new, I hit my home group right when they were in this part of the book. And there's two stories, this one, and it might have been worse. They're number 7 and 9 in kind of the middle section. But anyway, what this paragraph says is the story goes that this person went to a Super Bowl party and got totally trashed, and then had to go to a work function at a hockey game like less than a week later. And so while at the hockey game for work, they had to tone it down some because it was work. And so she sums it up by saying, on Super Bowl Sunday, when I enjoyed it, I couldn't control it. And at the hockey game, when I controlled it, I couldn't enjoy it. There was no more denying that I was an alcoholic, and what an epiphany. And I remember getting goosebumps when I read that paragraph, because that was basically me. That was basically it in a nutshell. And so that was one of the final straws that brought me to the realization that whether I liked it or not, whether it was my plan or not, whether I wanted it to be so or not, the simple fact is I'm an alcoholic. So from there, with that admission of step one, which I have to do every day, I can proceed forth from those steps, because step one really is a foundation. You know, it's the cornerstone, it's the foundation of all of it. I am powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable, and from there comes everything else. So as long as I keep that in the forefront of my mind, I can keep going through the steps. But as soon as I don't feel like doing one of the steps, or as soon as I don't feel like praying anymore, or as soon as I don't feel like going to a meeting or returning a phone call from another alcoholic, then I start slipping into having a real step one problem. Because if that's the case, if I'm an alcoholic, then I have to keep doing all of these things to make the rest of life possible.
All right, I'm going to do, we're short on time. I'm going to do the rest of the readings in one go and give you guys a couple minutes to stick the landing. Page 41. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends told me, how they prophesized if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who had said they had a problem that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. And on page 43, it says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
Okay? And this businessman is going and he's doing well, you know, and I didn't relate to that at all because I was so black and white. I'm not a businessman. I have no idea what going on the road means. I have no idea what being in a hotel means. I have no idea that, you know, going in a bar by myself when I'm doing good on a business trip means. And then, man, I go back and I'm like, this was 80 years ago, and I'll be, this is me. You know, a lot of you have heard this story, but I'm gonna share it real quick. I was voted Teacher of the Year by my colleagues, and they vote in the springtime, right? Drunkest I'd ever been in my life. These people voted me Teacher of the Year. So, during the summer, you get a parking space with your name on it. You get your name on the marquee. My family, everybody came and we took pictures with it. We did all of that. I was perfect, man. I was Teacher of the Year. Drank all summer. First week of school, I went to rehab, and the Teacher of the Year parking space is empty. And my name's on the marquee, and my name's on the sign, and there's an empty spot, and my principal has to explain where the Teacher of the Year is. Where's that dude?
Oh, he doesn't feel well.
I got, as it says in the big book, tight at just the right moment. You know, I couldn't do it. I couldn't have the highest honor colleagues could give me. Couldn't have it. Couldn't do it. Couldn't just be happy, the Teacher of the Year. I'm gonna get destroyed now. I would announce that anymore. I'm Teacher of the Year. What school do you teach at, bro? Because we're not going anywhere near that, you know? And I'll get to down here at the end. You know, we've said, James and I, some things that have made you laugh, and step one is hard, and there's some doom and gloom, and you gotta realize some heavy things. But man, it took me 10 months when I finally was ready to get through step one and stop saying Mike, because I got to that point of the jumping off point that we get to. I was yelling at my sponsor, this isn't working, this doesn't work. Because why don't you let it work? Why don't you do some work? And I was gonna die without a drop of alcohol. That's the craziest thing ever. Until his defense must come from a higher power. This guy writes this book, man, and he'll throw some sentences at you that's like, hey, dummy, read this. His defense must come from a higher power. And once I did that, and you'll get to step two next week and hear the next person, my life went crazy good. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.
So I guess the last couple of things I'd like to share, indulge me for a moment, is just in thinking about that whole alcoholic question and the powerlessness, etc. piece. There's really great advice in the big book, and going through it with a sponsor can be very, very helpful. I highly, highly recommend it. But honestly, I got started on one of the pamphlets is AA for you. There's 12 questions, and if you get four of them wrong, you're an alcoholic. They won't tell you that, but I can read between the lines. I'm pretty smart. I know when somebody's trying to tell me something that they really can't say, but they want to say. And it's really pretty simple. I mean, if you can fail that quiz, you need to take a hard look. The other thing that I'd like to share is, you know, so I've been sober 5.5 years. Okay, big deal. So what? For a good long time, until very recently, until like the past about year or so, I was really sure I was going to drink again. I mean, I knew, like in the depths of my mind, if I was going to be perfectly honest, 1,000% honest, I didn't know where, I didn't know when. I figured 10 years, 15, somehow, somewhere, it was going to happen again. It was inevitable because that's how I am, because I know me. You know, I know me, and I'm going to drink again, and I might be going to meetings, and I might be working the steps, and everything might be great, and I might be praying, and I might be okay right now today, but the day will come. what I have come since to realize then is that, you know, that day does not have to come. It really doesn't. I'm recovered. I don't have to drink again. That day is not inevitable. If I keep doing these things, if I keep working the steps out of the big book with a sponsor who does the same, I keep trying to give this back. You know, I'm very blessed and lucky to walk with some guys down the same path. They're doing the deal. I'm doing the deal. I got a strong home group. I got groups like Simple Actions to come to. The fellowship is here. There's people working out of this book are here. I'm being of service. I was secretary for my group for the past year. I'm about to switch over to GSR at the first of the year, right up there with making coffee and setting up chairs. If I do those things, then that day is not inevitable. It's really not. And that right now is the 1,000% truth. And that's the hope that I was hoping to be able to somehow be able to convey tonight, is that no matter where we are on this journey, whether it's brand new and totally confused, or old hat and picking up another white chip, or toying with that idea of maybe, you know, sitting in the ABC parking lot and kind of looking at the glittering bottles, and I just want to dance with the devil a little bit and have a little vicarious pleasure. I'm not actually going to drink. I just want to sit here and look at it. You do the steps, do the steps, do the steps, do the steps, do the steps. And they will work. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. We are going to pass the 7th Tradition Basket. 7th Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Your safety is important. Calling the proper authorities does not go against any AA traditions and is recommended when someone may have broken the law or endangered the safety of another person. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements for the benefit of AA? Nice and loud. No?
I got one if no one else does. There's a really cool workshop in Chesterfield, January 10 and 11. I've got some flyers I can share. There's a bunch of folks coming from all over the country and they're within driving range. Chesterfield, January 10 and 11. If you would like more information, just see me.
Are you talking about the Living Sober Conference?
It's I do believe that's
at Celebration Station with Bob Darrell and Don Major?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Some of us are going.
I know. Yes.
Malcolm.
Malcolm.
Hey, Malcolm.
January 5th, Sunday, January 5th, AA101 is having an anniversary celebration. We're serving breakfast at 10 o'clock, and we have a speaker at 11. We're at Norfolk General Hospital in Brick House Hospital, January 5th.
Thank you.
Thanks, Malcolm.
Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members. Newcomers, you are the reason we are here. Is there anyone here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. Everybody's a pro?
Alan, that's
Holly. Yeah, Alan.
Yeah.
Welcome.
How
are
you doing?
Welcome.
Anybody else? There's literature available over by the door. If you can fold it, it is free. Please see a home group member if you'd like to purchase a book. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come talk to me. Reminders. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. I'd like to thank everyone who participated. Could we thank this wonderful panel one more time? Let's see. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol at the intersection of Colonial and 22nd. It's just down the street. Kind of a volunteer to read the last three paragraphs on page 164. James?
Sounds like it might be a vision for you if I could ever get there. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who's still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right. Let's close. Let's go out in front of the table. It's just going to get more difficult from here. Our Father,
who art in heaven.